Hello, everyone. This is Susie Ward, welcoming you a little bit late to Matthew and Friends. There was just a little bit of a problem there making the phone connection, so I hope you're still with us. Our guest today, Janice Rose, is a dear gentleman and kindred spirit who is very special to me and my family. From early childhood on, Janice has had a reverence for all of nature. Life in the countryside of his homeland, Latvia, was peaceful and blissful until World War II abruptly ended that. Janice was 17, and Latvia was under German occupation when he and many other young men were separated from their families and sent to Germany. There he combined university studies in biology with working for the French occupation forces. And eventually he and two of his Latvian friends, who also wanted to be free of Europe's post-war turmoil, decided to embark on a more adventuresome life, and they chose Venezuela. They received doctoral degrees in biology, and later, as professors, they helped establish the College of Sciences and a zoological museum at the university. It was when they started expeditions into Venezuela's natural world that Janice was inspired to dedicate the rest of his life to preserving the environment from human destruction. It's my honor and a huge pleasure to welcome my dear friend, Janice Rose. Janice, hello. I'm so glad you can be with us today.
Oh, greetings. It is really a pleasure to share some nice things with you and with the wonderful audience that you have.
Good. So, we'll get right on it. Your migrations in Europe and South America eventually led to your settling in New York City in the early 1960s. Now, I know that you had dozens of pursuits there, and among them, you were one of the founders of the International Center for Integrative Studies. Why was the center established, and what has come out of it?
Oh, yeah. That was, you know, a very interesting effort there. You know, in 1960s, what we had was the explosion of the hippie revolution, and I was one who was trying to get to the Woodstock Festival around that time, but we felt that there had been so much fragmentation and so much separation in sciences and all walks of life. So we thought, would there be important to have an institute that would dedicate itself for this? Yes.
Okay. Excuse us, listeners. The producer cut in to let us know that Janice's voice can't be heard easily. So, let's get going again, please. Janice, you were speaking about the fragmentation that was going on and how you wanted to do something to bring this back together, a cohesive group of like-minded people.
Yeah, indeed. You know, at that time, what we found, there were many people excellent in their disciplines, so to say, and they knew that that is not enough to be excellent in one's discipline. If one area is wonderful, because it's very comfortable, you know everything what you have to know in that, but at the same time, they were like separate islands that were floating somewhere in space. And we felt the time has come really to invite these people to come forward and tell that there is more to that. In a way, at that time, we were saying, my discipline, my specialty, my way of thinking and knowing is valid to the extent to which it is valid also for other disciplines, for other areas. And we found that the response of such a crazy idea at that time to integrate knowledge, to integrate ways of life, was unusual. But whenever we went with whomever we talked, they said, gee, indeed, time has come for humanity to bring us together again, like there is more one consciousness rather than hundreds of consciousnesses. And so we started that, and after a while we had about 300 participants about, and they came from 35 countries. We had the most incredible people there, like Nobel Prize winners who said, gee, we have to go further than the excellence there. Werner Heisenberg, for example, the famous German physicist. We had presidents of countries there. Rodrigo Carazo was one at that time president of Costa Rica. And he said also, what can we do in the country here to bring things together? And then we certainly had many of these, that time, very famous humanistic psychology people, Abraham Maslow, Rollo May, Carl Rogers, all of them somehow said, yes, time has come that we integrate the thinking and knowing and being. So we went for about 15, 20, oh, almost 30 years, very, very strong. And the exchange was really superb. And it was, at that time, I remember, it was something very new. Something very unusual. How come you are bringing together? We are busy with our specialties, you know. How do you bother us to invite us to think about something else? And yet, that was on the agenda as if a history. And there was one of our participants, very dear friend, Pitirim Sorokin. He was a person who wrote at that time Ways and Power of Love. And he was at Harvard University. And he said, yes, that is on the agenda of our cultural history. And now we have to support it as much as we possibly can. So that was about, should we say, the overall idea about the International Center.
You said that I believe you mentioned it lasted for about 30 years, the effectiveness of bringing those people together?
Yes, that was about very active. But then, you see, it was a pre-computer time, and we had an exchange. We had we called it the ISIS Forum, ISIS coming from International Center for Integrative Studies. And at that time, there were no computers, no emails to exchange. The only way to exchange was on snail mail. So we had the forum going, and people could send in as their ideas prefabricated before they were officially, let's say, launched in the big world. And we could discuss them in, so to say, between us. And that between us turned out to build a kind of a very special fellowship. I would say there was a consciousness of ISIS that grew around that time, and it was fed by very many different ways of thinking. It was really marvelous. At that time, whenever I went to congresses or meetings, and I did have opportunity to travel to quite a few congresses internationally also. And when I was associated with the UN, then also there were lots of congresses. And whenever I went, I met our people, like the fifth column, the hidden remnant, as it could be called, people who felt that we have to save humanity, integrate the world, make the world one again.
Well, you know, that sounds like such a wonderful foundation, and being effective. If you look at the world today, I have to think what happened? How did that consciousness that was becoming so strong then seemed to disintegrate. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it has continued. And I'm just looking at the politics that seems to be so volatile now.
Yeah, but you know, it did not disintegrate. It kind of, I would, you know, my perception is that whatever we say, we do, and think, kind of introduce things is what you should say, collective consciousness, whatever term you use. And all those efforts in some way or another remain as part of human baggage, if you want to say, or human cultural reality. And it took other aspects, you know. Suddenly the integration became somewhat, the globalization was one aspect. Unfortunately, the globalization, as it is perceived now, we all know that is really the anti-globalization, as uniformization, you know, and the reduction humanity of purely economic common denominators. But that is also a way of globalization, to bring together people, to realize that each one of us in some ways contribute to the others. No?
You're right. I was being very short-sighted in not realizing that all of the wonderful ideas and harmony and cooperation, all of that energy that was emerging and solidifying during that time of much more activity in the center, obviously is now in the collective consciousness, and all of us who are having those types of thoughts are reaching that and expanding it. So thank you, Dennis, for mentioning that. This is quite a digression, but I do want to mention that I really love the synchronicity of your meeting and marrying the young professor from Colombia, the country in South America, not the university. She decided to become a biologist after she read a book that you had translated from German into Spanish, I believe. But at any rate, she didn't know you then. You had this fortunate meeting later on, and you married. Okay. I just think that's such a delightful turn of events there.
Well, it was mind-blowing for us, too. You know, because without knowing anything, I was at that time living in Venezuela, and there was a shortage of all kinds of zoology books in Spanish. So I took that one book that was called Animal Kingdom and translated into Spanish with the idea that people will have access to more information. Remember, there was no computers at that time, nothing. And the surprise was, well, my wife-to-be came to United States, and when I was a professor here at the university, and she started putting her thesis together and so on. Excuse me. So we got together, and she got her thesis together. And so we get married on the way, and that was just wonderful. And then came the great surprise when she started telling me, I asked her, how come you got involved into biology living in Colombia? Oh, she said, well, I was not sure what I want to do. I went to the library in Bogota, in Colombia, and I started looking at books at architecture, medicine, biology. And then I found a book, she said, that was called Animal Kingdom. And when I read about 10, 20 pages of that, I said, yes, that is what I want to study. She went home, declared to her family, I am going to be a biologist. And of course, her father was very upset. Oh, you will die from hunger and so on, as the fathers usually are. And yet she studied biology, and she wrapped in special paper that book and had it in her library. And one day I went to Colombia to visit something there, and also her family, and we started talking about the book, and I said, well, you know that book, Reino Animal, Animal Kingdom. Oh, yes, they said, we know that was the book that Amanda had a very special meaning. I said, can you get the book? Well, somebody rushed into the place where Amanda used to live and came out with the book, and I told him, open the book. They opened the book, and what it says in the first page, it says, translated by Janice Rosay. And they nearly fall apart there at that moment. And as it was about 20 years later, that book was the one that led Amanda to meet me, because she studied biology. And knowingly, I translated the book so that I can have a decent wife.
Well, yes. Sometimes it's very difficult to look 20 years into our futures, isn't it? Well, you're both lovers of nature, and you've done a tremendous amount of traveling to lecture on preserving the animal and plant kingdoms. And along the way, you have discovered sacred places, and you have opened their energy vortexes. Would you please talk about how you found those places and what you did to activate their dormant energy?
Yeah, well, that's it. Yeah, it's indeed, I am more and more convinced that as we live on and we don't demand too much from the life, because our usual attitude, oh, the life must entertain me, the people must do something nice for me, and that's fine, and we all have it. But, you know, after a while, that eagerness, my eagerness, gets reduced. And so my interest started, well, of course, what you said is quite true. We really deeply, deeply love nature. It is literally that living part of all of us. And but in addition to that, we started around what people have done in the far distant past. And as I had the privilege of traveling a lot around South America, I have been in all South and Central American countries, except Belize in Central America and except French Guiana. These have not been part of my itineraries. But then we started feeling that we as humanity are really approaching, I would say, to a moment or to a time in our history in which we had to bring back energies that have been active in the past, like energies of the people of past lives, the cultures that lived in the past and all that. And as we said, you know, everything stays in our collective consciousness, you know, even though we are not aware of it. So I started thinking that there are many places that, well, somehow the places started to inviting me, to said, hey, we have to become part of now moment. And so that gradually either somebody told me or I stumbled upon them, or simply and plainly somebody from far distant beyond gave indication. We started discovering these sacred places, and indeed they are sacred places. Probably every piece of the earth is sacred, but they are simply places that have been utilized by past civilizations in the sense of kind of invoking that deeper spirituality that's well beyond what we are living daily. And to invoke the deeper spirituality was also kind of concentrated moments or places, well, like vortices, like energy centers or chakras. It doesn't matter how they are called. And so we started stumbling upon one after another. And the interesting part, well, let me very briefly tell about some of them. Of course, the most famous place in South America is Machu Picchu in Peru. That was one of the great Inca centers. And there are many, many tourists that are going there. And at that time, we were filming a documentary that is called Human Genetic Rivers. But that is for a next interview. And then we realized that what we are stumbling at on what is called Intihuatana. And Intihuatana in Machu Picchu is it has been described as the vertical point that points to all cardinal places, and at the same time, in short, it is a center of observatory for cosmic events that are around the Earth. And it has been staying there, and it has been for a very long time, of course, long before it was discovered, I guess in 1911, probably there. It was unknown, but the Incas knew it, and Incas used it. And when you approach to that particular spot in Machu Picchu, you really feel in your stomach or in your gut, excuse me, or in your heart, that there is a very special energy that is there. And we felt that energy is kind of waiting to be awakened, waiting to be recognized. And as I had my two friends, Hugo, who is an Argentinian friend from Buenos Aires, Robbie is another rather famous TV man from Buenos Aires. We three were there. We said, let us make a little ceremony and see what we can discover related to that particular center. And it was so interesting that they were full with tourists. And the moment that we decided, well, we should maybe do some kind of a little recognition of that center around it, all the tourists gradually disappeared. And there was about 15, 20 minutes, no one even came to there. And we used that opportunity to make our little invocation. And, you know, I carry with me for years some of the North American Navajo and Zuni chants, and they are very good to invoke in nature things that are much more authentic than probably many of the modern things that are also important and also authentic. And so,
Janice, excuse me just a moment, please. I think your voice, your volume is fading a bit.
It's fading again. Okay,
yes.
I will try to reconstruct my voice.
But thank you. Just
okay. Yeah.
Yelling would be good.
Okay. Yeah. And well, in that little ceremony, we really felt that there is some wonderful things happening. And Hugo has a very special perception. Hugo, one of my friends, and he started telling us what he perceived is. From the mountaintops from around Machu Picchu, they are energies coming and relating and mixing and integrating with that particular center. And it was really marvelous to see that that indeed is taking place. So that was, we were very pleased, very exhausted certainly after our little experience, but these were the things that began to happen again. Not too long time ago, to just give you another example, in Argentina, in San Luis, wise people from South told me, you know, if there's a possibility to find in San Luis, who has been a very ancient center of civilizations well beyond and behind our civilization, there were places of initiation. And it would be interesting to find them. And then I thought, well, when we were at ISIS Center, what we did was we went to some of the North American places here, like Window Rock, you know, the Navajo Center. And there were several others of them. And at that time, in some way, what we did as a group, and they were a little group of friends, but we went there, we made a triangle of us, we made a circle, and we made a cross with us, like human crosses. And I felt that we should find a place somewhere in San Luis that would have that particular, these particular signs. So I wrote some friends who were in San Luis, very dear friends, kind of spiritually oriented a little bit, and lovers of nature as well. And they live in San Luis, and they started looking for that, and nothing. And about 1 year later, I have a very urgent message. We found a place that you might be looking for. Said and done, I rushed to Argentina, gathered my other friends from Buenos Aires, and we went to that particular place. Susie, that is an absolutely magical place. The inscriptions, the petroglyphs, in some way we found half hidden in the rock, kind of a rock place, huge rock boulders were there. We found the triangle, kind of open, half closed. We certainly found the circle, and we certainly found the cross. That when you looked across that place on the other side, about 20 meters on that cross, there was another huge wall with petroglyphs. And they had stars, planetary systems, and all that you could think of people interested in cosmic energies. So we felt, my goodness, that seems to be indeed one of the centers that has been used as a my friend said, well, before all that our history knows. And so we made a little ceremony, a little enchantment. We invoked the four... Hello?
Hello?
Yes. We invoked the all cardinal points and heaven and earth and water and fire. And again, there were energies that Ugo, who also was, of course, with me, said, yes, I see all the energies again coming and gathering, and there are several more stones in the area that participate in the configuration of that particular energy center. Well, that was also wonderful. And now they are keeping an eye on that center, the local friends there. So that these are the two of the examples. Well, let me throw in one more example as you incited my interest. There is one interesting center, and it is between New Mexico and Arizona. It is a very ancient Zuni center, and most of the Zunis don't know it anymore. And there is a kind of an amphitheater hidden from the site because it is inside the rock formations or hill formations that is there. And again, that was a place that we visited while we were together with the ISIS group that I mentioned from New York. And at that time, we felt we had a very wise person leading us at that time. He was from Sweden. And at that time, I was the daredevil that I would sneak in wherever I could and also could not. I was young at that time. And so I went down, I found a way to climb down in that amphitheater. And my goodness, when you stood in the middle, there was in the center, it was really like an amphitheater. And in the center was like an obelisk, one would say, a natural obelisk. And when you stood at that obelisk, then it looked that the time began to disappear, you know, like you stood, period, you know, the time dimensions, the histories and one's own life kind of get pretty much diluted at that time. And that gave me also an indication that apparently we are here in front and honoring one of the tremendous spiritual centers or vortices of energy that probably the Zuni or the people at least among the Zuni who knew it have been utilizing for their spiritual ceremonies and so on. Well, there are quite a few more, but you know, these are kind of examples. And my impression is that wherever we go around, I guess one should be a little bit open. Is that place in which I am, especially, you know, away from main cities, is that a place that have a significance for something that is beyond what is seen and what is heard? And especially in places where the original peoples lived, you know. I'm talking in North and South America, Powell.
Well, it's, I think that all people who, all of us who are on this soul-searching journey to open our consciousness, open our minds to what our souls know, and since we understand that everything is energy, there is no separation really. We see separation, you know, in this rock, that rock, the individual trees, the individual people, but the energy is flowing among everything. And so it does seem natural, doesn't it, when you can be in a place where previous civilizations were so attuned to the oneness of all and the energy flowing, where they are really, each individual is a part of everything else, that the energy created by that closeness of the individuals, the cultures, with their surroundings, is there. And perhaps because it has been sort of the area, I mean, has been lost to a lot of human contact, that energy is still there in its pristine condition, without the dilution of 3D world that we're that we're in right now.
Yeah,
and it's just there, waiting for individuals like you and your friends to come in to discover it and activate it in a way, sort of free it from, say, the isolation as we perceive it, and let it start flowing magnificently again. Am I anywhere close?
You know, in some ways, the impression that I have it, and I have had it for quite a few years, is that, you know, we are kind of beginning to live a new life, new civilization, if you want to. The old one was wonderful, but it is really finishing. And even look at the physics, you know, the classical physics is totally replaced by, well, what they call particle physics or quantum physics. In biology, we are looking that, for example, the DNA, the famous molecule of genetics, it has only 10% of it contains the genetic information for building a next body. 90% of that is not participating in that. What does it do? And these are the questions that are beginning raised and are surprising. But it's not only the new ways of thinking and understanding. You know, we are, I think, inviting all those ancient places, those ancient energies, as you said, that they become part of what we are doing now at this moment in the world. And again, I would say, the more we can integrate in our consciousness, and here again, it's interesting, it is not that I make them happen to be alive, but it makes itself to happen to be alive, because we inviting and we humbly inviting and really that these energies to become alive. Let me tell you one more very interesting thing that we also stumbled upon almost unknowingly. You know, in Rio de Janeiro, there is this famous Christ figure, Cristo Redentor, as they call it, you know, the overlooking the entire Rio de Janeiro. And behind, around that particular, figure, it's stupendous. I recommend everybody to go there and admire it. Behind, around that, there is a rainforest, untouched rainforest, that the last emperor of Portugal, remember, the emperor of Portugal went over and established his kingdom in Brazil. And what he said, he chased away all the coffee plantations, and he said, this will be a great forest. And they gathered all the wonderful trees, rainforest trees, from around Brazil and South America. But then he imported enormous quantities from Europe, from Africa, from Asia. So it is a rainforest that is totally integrated as a forest. And it is harmonious. It is not disharmonious. It was one example where you can also integrate nature, not only human beings, you know. And behind that Christ figure, this splendorous figure, we stumbled up. Actually, Hugo discovered that we were going around there, and my goodness, there was another enormous energy center in a simple valley there. Some rock formations were there, and when you stood there, you had the feeling, my goodness, you are with one foot, you are sitting on the lap of the Christ that is up there, and the energies were flowing. And what was so interesting was, well, of course, we made our little American Indian ceremony there, inviting the energy to be activated, the center. And, you know, these all things form part, I think, to kind of what we call the new knowledge in sciences. That is new knowledge in human evolution, in terms of geology, in terms of nature, and in terms, above all, what the people have produced throughout human evolution as cultures and civilizations.
Janice, you know, obviously, thank you for all of that information. And I know we could keep on that. But there's something that, to me, is extremely important. I want you to have time to talk about this. You've written a lot of books, actually mostly in languages other than English. And so the only book that I know is the one that you and two friends co-edited. And the title is, What Does It Mean to Be Human? It's one of the most inspirational books I've ever read. My children feel the same, which you know. And last week I received an email from someone who shares our opinion about that book. He wrote because he read in Matthew's message that you would be on the show today. I would like you to tell our listeners how the idea for that remarkable book came about, and also if you would share a bit about some of the contributors. There were over 90 contributors to that book, and the
Okay. Very briefly, of course, the book is What Does It Mean to Be Human? And it came about in, again, most inverosimilar way. I have a very dear friend, Frederick Frank. He is on the other side of the fence now, recently went. And we came together once in a while, pondering on life and love and sufferings and joys and so on. And then one day he said, listen, the world is so bad off that we should do something about it. Well, I said, ready, we are ready. We will do something. And so we started getting together, about four or five of us, in a little cafe in New York, in the Village. And we started talking and started talking. And after a third or fourth meeting, we said, actually, what we are trying to do is establish a kind of an anti-barbaric coalition. So the coalition against the barbaric things that the society is allowing to happen. But then we said, anti is not a very good thing. We should be something pro. And then we said, well, there was Albert Schweitzer, who was the one that declared the reverence for all life. And we felt that was a very, very important thing to bring once more to the public. And so we started gathering, inviting people whomever we thought would be interested in answering the question, what does it mean to be human? And the more we wrote, the more surprising we were. And of course, we invited a whole series of well, what it's a quite famous name. Dalai Lama sent one. Oscar Arias, who is now the president of Costa Rica. At that time, he was not president. Mother Teresa wrote us also. Eli Wiesel, the famous voice for human sanity. Vaclav Havel, the president of Czechoslovakia, Czechoslovakia. And we had Yehudi Menuhin, for example. Interesting. They all felt that they would like to say something, what is important for being human, or what they felt, what does it mean to be human. And we certainly, when we wrote them, we said, no, we don't need the philosophy, what does it mean to be human. We want you to talk out of your heart. You need to inquire within yourself, from your life experience, your way of thinking, your way of being, what does that really happen? And it was Archbishop Desmond Tutu that many people know also wrote this. And there were many, many more. But you know, they were not only the famous people. We asked, for example, a tire dealer in New Jersey. That was our friend. Well, what do you think? What does it mean to be human? And he had things to say. I had at the university a student from Nigeria who was really coming from the tribal area. And I asked him, what do you think? What does it mean to be human? And he wrote a beautiful description about that. And as a result, was there was the fantastic puzzle that has put together that we felt approximated to what is the sense of being human. And you know, let me add a little bit more about Frederick Frank. He died, I think, 96 years old recently. And he was in his young years, he was a Dutchman. He worked with Albert Schweitzer in Africa. And many people even don't remember Albert Schweitzer. He was one of the very, very first really human communicators with compassion. And lived in Africa, he had his hospital there. And Frederick was a dentist at that time, and he worked for him 7 years. When he returned back to United States, he established in Warwick, that's near New York, upstate New York, what he called an icon garden. He became artist more than anything else. He gave up the dentistry, and he became a very fine artist. Some of the books is Zen Seeing, Zen Drawing. He was one of the artists that was trans artist, so to say. And he started building icons, which we call them. They are sculpture, for example, they are sculpture of Buddha's eye, the Earth Mother. They are sculptures of St. Francis and with his birds. And they are one sculpture that was very famous, the unkillable human. He usually used a very large steel plates or iron plates, and he cut out a smaller figure out of the larger, and he put it in three-dimensionally away. And the unkillable human was one of the sculptures that was brought to Hiroshima as a reminder that you can destroy individual peoples, but there is an unkillable human that is in all of us that continues living. Another sculpture, he had what we call the seven generations. And again, they were figure within the figure within the figure. And as it turned out, in the six of these figures that are smaller and smaller and smaller, and the seventh was a red heart in the seventh figure. And he took that from the Iroquois confederation, the idea, when they said this, when we come together in council, our decisions, we have to be aware, will affect seven generations to come. So he wanted to show that through his sculptures. And he has written about, I think, 32 books or something. And it is with him that we got together, and it was probably one of his last books that we put out, and it was wonderful to meet him. Now it is a museum. It was declared by New York State a museum, and there are two or three large areas where all his icons are put up for observation. Of course, entrance is free, and it is really a magical place, I would say. People who enter there, they come out almost changed, or at least very deeply impressed. And that is the beauty, you know. I am scientist by training and by conviction and everything else. But, you know, science doesn't impede of the greatness of spirituality. The contrary, there is this beautiful complementarity. And I am finding it more and more real, and not real because people say that, but I feel it in my heart. And I think sooner or later we will understand what you said very much at the beginning. All is somehow one. All is a great integrated whole.
Yes. I'm glad that I made a little contribution here. You know, what I felt was so stirring about that book. It's very few books that can evoke laughs, smiles, and tears, and remain with me in my mind about the specific individuals who overcame so much. Deprivations of one kind or another, grief, real struggles, and the triumph of the spirit that comes through in their various stories. And as you say, some of these are internationally known people, and others are perhaps very well known in their specialty fields. And others are just really beautiful souls whose spirit radiates. You know, I wish that everyone could have a copy of this book, because it is so inspirational. It lets us know how we can get past struggling and rise into the joy of being a human, the goodness in human nature, and the strength of spirit that lets us rise above the hardships. I think it's such a valuable, it's, to me, that book is a treasure trove of specific examples, a collection of many examples that can inspire us to move forward, to open our hearts and realize that we can make it, in essence. This is sort of the bottom line. They made it. We can make it. I have to interrupt here to mention the next radio show. And when I come back, Janice, would you please t- tell us what you envision for Earth, and what we as individuals can do that will be most helpful to spread love and anchor the light so that we can contribute to that vision. So I want you to be able to think about that. And I just need a moment or two here to say that our next show will be October 29th. Ani Avedisian will be Matthews and my guest. Ani is a clairvoyant psychic, medical intuitive, and energy healer. She's Armenian, but she grew up in England. And so in addition to your hearing some very enlightening information, you can be prepared for a British accent and Ani's delightful sense of humor. If you would like to check out her website before the show, it's www.anaavedisian.com. Ani Avedisian. So please mark on your calendars to join Ani and me October 29th. And now, Janice, back to you.
Okay. You said actually very many interesting things in your comments about what is the human nature, you know, as you were talking about what does it mean to be human. You know, I am at my advanced stage of decomposition. I am beginning more and more in a way leaning toward understanding that the greatness of life in itself contains everything that is there. And I think that our next steps, and I like to think about evolution, being biologist, in evolution they are quantum jumps. We call it in biology punctuated equilibrium. And we are, as humanity, approaching to a punctuated equilibrium. That is an enormous jump that will be done. And at the same time, then it will be a new platform that will be reached. Equal as you have it in animal world. And for that, everything that is now at this moment begins to emerge. You know, we have all the disaster, all the economic disaster, the financial things, the wars. It couldn't be worse in some way, the world. But that is on the surface. That is on the surface. And the moment we can put aside a little bit our concerns about the now moment, well, about the present moment, we begin to listen, we begin to perceive that there is a new way, really, that new evolutionary step that is happening. It is happening there. It is effervescent. It is full of life. And it is very, very much alive. And therefore, anything that we do will lead to that new way. And certainly, that will be much more harmonious, much more human. We are living today a semi-human life. That will be more fully human. And I put all my money on that.
Janice, dear, thank you so much for everything that you've been sharing with us during the past 55 minutes. Matthew and I are just so very grateful for your presence in our lives. And I thank you again today. For today, I know we'll be speaking again soon. I wish we had more time today to go on. There's so much more I know about you that I wish we could share with listeners. But our time is up. And so now, Matthew and I send love and blessings and peace to you, Janice, dear, and to all of our listeners. Indeed, to all of the world. So that's it for today. Goodbye, everyone.